saving tigers with international cooperation, even between geopolitical enemies.
For conservation of large species like tigers, where their range transcends borders. And so I've been encouraged to see that there are still collaborations continuing, given the recent geopolitical tensions between Russia and the West. People are still viewing conservation issues in the correct light, and that these are international issues that transcend politics and need to be addressed in a collective, collaborative fashion.
That's Jonathan Slatt. Later in the show, we talk with him about his book, Tigers Between Empires, The Improbable Return of Great Cats to the Forests of Russia and China. Slatt tells a story of the 35-year-old Siberian Tiger Project, one of the longest-running wildlife studies in the world, and how science, persistence, and cross-border collaboration helped bring a species back from the edge of extinction. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Deep in the forests of Northeast Asia roam secretive Amur tigers, more popularly known as Siberian tigers. But in the final years of the Cold War, only a few hundred of these graceful animals remained. As the Soviet Union fell, catastrophe arrived, with poaching and logging taking a fast, astonishing toll on an already vulnerable species. In his book, Tigers Between Empires, conservationist Jonathan Slatt charts the incredible story of how Russian and American scientists came together to save these magnificent, solitary creatures. He retraces their steps to show how this dedicated coalition laid the foundations of new tiger research across Asia, transforming public opinion around tigers from something to be feared and hunted to creatures we must protect. Slate shows us that the revival of the Amur tiger can bring us hope for the future, a model for how to live alongside and revive the natural world. Slatt has written several previous books, including the much-acclaimed Owls of the Eastern Ice. Jonathan Slatt, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This book, Tigers Between Empires, describes the longest-running tiger study anywhere, 35-year endeavor, a remarkable project that involved both Russian and American scientists and also worked with China. This is just an amazing story. I want to start out where you start out in this book, which is with a tiger named Lydia on a cliff, basking in the sun above the Sea of Japan while a biplane circles overhead. What is this tiger's seven-year record of three litters? Tell us about how a single tigress can anchor the recovery of an entire landscape.
Yeah, so the whole way that the Siberian Tiger Project did their research was innovative. So a lot of scientific research projects, including some that I've directed, are really based on short snapshots of a tiger's life, where you catch an animal. You attach some kind of device that tracks its movements for a year, maybe two, depending on what the device is. And then that's it. And you've had just this brief snapshot of maybe an animal's adolescence, maybe its adulthood, maybe how it dies. What the Siberian Tiger Project decided to do early on, or tried to do early on, was monitor individual tigers throughout their entire lives. So when they could catch a young tiger as a cub or as a young adult, they would try to recapture that same tiger some years later before the battery on its tracking device ran out, so within 2 or 3 years. And that way they would be able to follow that single individual, so learn how an animal survives through adolescence, what their movement patterns are, what they eat as they expand to try to find their own territories. At what age do they first reproduce? How many young do they have in each litter? How many litters do they have in a lifespan? And what's the average age that these animals live? And so Lydia was one of the tigers who kind of came in the middle of this program when the methodologies were already developed, and they could track her from a very young age through her adulthood. And by having that kind of data, so full life data of a species, that really allows you to dial in where the conservation stressors are and how best then conservationists can alleviate those stressors through management mitigations.
Yeah, and now that we know a little bit about Lydia, tell us more about yourself. How did you get involved in this project, writing about it, and why did you move from owls to tigers?
So I have a long history in the Russian Far East. I went first as a teenager in 1995, and then later spent 6 months in the region as a student in 1997. And then in 1999, I moved there to Vladivostok, well, to the province of Primorye, which has the capital of Vladivostok, in 1999 for 3 years in the Peace Corps. And during that time, that was when I really met the American side of the Siberian Tiger Project, because I was living in Ternay, a small coastal village, which was the headquarters of the Siberian Tiger Project. And there were only two other Americans in that town. It was Dale Mikel, who was one of the founders of the project, and then John Goodrich, who came a few years later. It was, of course, really interesting and exciting for me to be living in a place where the people I would socialize with, because we were the only foreigners, were doing these amazing things with tigers. And I think it was interesting for them too, because they would start to invite me along on some of their activities. So I remember I'd be sitting on a Saturday morning drinking coffee in my kitchen, and I'd hear a truck outside and look, and there's John Goodrich. He says, "Hey, do you want to go try to catch a tiger in a helicopter? Or, do you want to spend a weekend tracking tigers along the coast?" Incredibly exciting stuff for someone who wasn't a scientist at the time. I was just a Peace Corps volunteer. And as that relationship developed, Dale Mikel decided to try to nurture the naturalist in me and encouraged me to go to graduate school to study wildlife in the Russian Far East, because there was a real need for wildlife conservation in this place. And so I did, and I've always been in, well, not always, but I've been interested in birds since college, and not really interested in mammals so much. And so I did master's work in the region with songbirds, and then I did PhD work with black and fish owls, which was the story in Owls of the Eastern Ice. And then after that, I was hired by the Wildlife Conservation Society's Russia program, which had managed the Siberian Tiger Project since, I think it was 1997 or so. And I started working for them and started taking on more responsibilities related to tigers. And Dale Mikel, who I said was one of the founders of the Siberian Tiger Project and had been in Russia since 1992, for years he's been saying, "One day I'm going to write a book about this stuff, because strange things happen. It's an exciting project. It's a dangerous species to be working with, and there are always these adventures that Dale would be telling me about." And after the success of my owl book, I had a talk with Dale, and I said, "Dale, are you ever really going to write a book about this?" And a concern that I had was that he never would. He's already reached retirement age. He just retired a few weeks ago officially, and I convinced him that I could tell the story, and he agreed to this. And that's how I came to write the book.
In the title, you have Tigers Between Empires. You trace the modern fate of the Siberian, or should we call it the Amur tiger? Which is better?
So there are no tigers in Siberia. Siberia is a defined administrative region in the middle of Russia, and Amur tigers are all found and have always been found in the Russian Far East, also an administrative region, and specifically in the Amur River Basin. And the Amur River forms part of the border, the contemporary border between Russia and China. And so Amur is the preferred term because it's accurate. I wish it wasn't called the Siberian Tiger Project when they came out with it in 1992, but it's just, Siberian Tiger is just the term that's more commonly used. And so that's why I think it was called the Siberian Tiger Project back then.
Well, maybe we'll keep on with the Siberian tiger, but it's good to
Right.
know that. So back to my question, between empires, this tiger between the empires of Russia and China, you trace the modern fate of the Siberian tiger to the 1858 Treaty of Aigun and the 1860 Convention of Peace. Peking, these were lines that were drawn across the range of the tigers. How did these borders first endanger the cats, and how are they now ironically helping to protect them?
So in 1850, almost the entire range of Amur tigers was within Chinese territory. China was at the time ruled by the Qing dynasty. And the Qing's home range was actually sort of the center of Amur tiger habitat in Northeast Asia. So while they ruled out of Beijing to the southwest of there, their homeland was sort of, you know, the Amur River Basin, more or less. And they protected it from other groups. So they built this thing called the Willow Palisade, which was a wall, a double wall made of interlocking trees that was 700 kilometers long. And the purpose of this wall was to keep out ethnic Koreans, ethnic Han Chinese, and Mongolians from going into the Qing homeland and extracting resources. So hunting or collecting wood or ginseng. And the only people really allowed into that area was the royal family and their bannermen. And so, in effect, the Qing were able to create this de facto protected area. There's a whole huge swath of Northeast Asia by keeping most people out. And then way far in the north was the border with the Russian Empire. And then in 1858, as I mentioned, with the Treaty of Aigun, and then the Convention of Peking in 1860, the Russians came to the Chinese and said, we think this is what the border should look like now. And these were considered unequal treaties because the Russians gained everything and the Chinese nothing. The Chinese were relatively weak. They were dealing with internal tensions, and they really couldn't afford to have a fight with a neighboring empire in the north. So they sort of conceded. And essentially, the border then shrunk much further to the south, to the Amur River, and then hinging even further south along the Ussuri River. And if you look at a map, this essentially cleaves historical Amur tiger habitat in half by this border. And once the border was there, the Willow Palisade lost all its value. The Qing were now eager to have citizens of China populate these lands, you know, perhaps so that the Russians wouldn't try to come and take more. And so, you know, the floodgates opened, Han Chinese moved in, forests were cleared for agriculture, and the Amur tigers were really pushed further north and further east into what is now Russian territory. The Russians at this time were doing the same thing. They were also moving their settlers in. A lot of people from what's now Ukraine settled in this area. And the Russian colonists brought with them the, you know, 19th century mentality of big game hunting. And they had rifles, they had other weapons, and they started to shoot and kill a lot of tigers for trophy hunting and also to capture young cubs for zoo and circus markets throughout the world. And so tigers really were, they were caught here between empires, these competing forces of, you know, losing habitat and human disturbance coming up from China, and then just kind of, you know, slaughter coming in from the north. And that really impacted tiger populations. So in 1850, say, we think there are about 3,000 total Amur tigers in that area or in that subspecies. And by 1940, they were down to about 500, where most of those were in China, and only 20 to 30 left in Russia.
This species, through this project, rebounded tremendously. How concentrated was the gene pool? Were there problems with the fact that it rebounded from such a small population? And how has genetic diversity been maintained?
The 1940s were the turning point, late 1940s, early 1950s, because this was when there was a Russian biologist named Lev Kaplanov who was first to really identify that there was a serious problem, that the population had crashed in Russia. So he did the first population surveys in Russia. He came up with this 20 to 30 number, and he successfully argued to protect the species. So within Russia, you know, hunting was first banned, and then the capture of live cubs was banned a few years later. And that, in conjunction with some new protected areas in Russia, which were established in the 1930s, this allowed Amur tigers to actually recover. And it's the only tiger subspecies, of which there are nine recognized, the only tiger subspecies that showed a population recovery throughout the 20th century. Meanwhile, on the other side of the border in China, remember we started, so at the time that there were 20 to 30 in Russia, there were about 500 in China. Tigers probably continued to cross the border and helped repopulate, help the Russian population grow, but then they continued to be hammered. You know, there was the The Japanese Empire came into Northeast China, into Manchuria, and had a puppet state called Manchukuo. And once that was defeated, then Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution, and there were pest eradication campaigns. So tigers continued to dwindle on the China side of the border throughout the 20th century, while they were increasing on the Russian side of the border. So we're not going necessarily from a population of only 20 or 30. There were infusions from the Chinese side as well that were able to help foster that population recovery. But by the time the Siberian Tiger Project started in 1991 in Russia, tigers were almost completely gone from the Chinese side. Dale Mikkel and some others from the Siberian Tiger Project, including Igor Nikolaev and Dima Pikanov, they did some surveys in China in 1998 and 1999 and found there were only about a dozen tigers left there, while at that point there were probably 400, 450 in Russia.
So what were the pivotal policy levers, the practices on the ground that turned that decline into a rebound in China as well as in Russia?
I think of both countries' population recovery. So I will add, so while there were only about a dozen tigers in China, more tigers in China in 1998-1999, most recent estimates from last year are about 80. So they are coming back there in China as well. And I think in both cases, the recovery of tigers in Russia and in China, it has to do with, frankly, the kind of governments that these countries have. They're very authoritarian and top-down, right? When someone at the top says something, people listen because of the fears of what might happen if they don't. And so in Russia, having someone like Stalin in charge was a pretty motivating factor in whether people were going to be trying to poach tigers or not.
You've mentioned Dale Mikkel. Tell us who Maurice Honecker was, or Honecker was, and his philosophy of green fire. I've heard the phrase green fire applied to environmentalism before, but I never knew that it was due to this conservationist.
Yeah, so Maurice Hornacker, he was really the founder of the Siberian Tiger Project from the U.S. side. And to my shame, I didn't know much about him either before researching this project, because his involvement in the Siberian Tiger Project had largely ended by the time I came to know members of the team. Morris is a pretty remarkable and influential wildlife biologist in the United States. He worked with the Craighead brothers, John and Frank Craighead, who are these legendary wildlife biologists. And they sort of shared a philosophy with Aldo Leopold, who's the individual who wrote about the green fire in his remarkably influential and beautiful book, A Sands County Almanac. So at the time that the Craigheads, and when Morris was a graduate student, and Aldo Leopold's time, the prevailing view of wildlife management in the United States was one of predator eradication. Right, there's wolves, there's cougars, there's coyote. If we have fewer of those things, that will mean we'll have more game, which is what's interesting for hunters. So that's sort of the management we should follow. And the green fire comes from a line in Leopold's Sand County Almanac, where as a youngster, he shoots this wolf because he also believed in predator eradication. And he comes up to the wolf after shooting it, just as it's dying. And it's a beautiful passage. And he talks about seeing the green fire go out in the wolf's eyes, sort of the first time, realizing like, wait, there are bigger things at play here. Wolves are just as important in the system. We have to have wolves to have healthy deer populations, and it's all interconnected. And that was a philosophy that Morris brought to cougars in North America, because no one had been doing that. No one had been viewing cougars as an essential component. And so he was the first person to capture cougars and put radio collars on them and track them to better understand their movements to guide actual management of those populations. And this was a practice that he brought to other big cats around the world. He informed jaguar research in South America. One of his graduate students, Howard Quigley, worked on that. And Howard was also one of the founding members of the Siberian Tiger Project. He worked with leopards in Africa, and finally with tigers in Russia. And a really interesting thing that I found out, a character trait, I suppose you would say, I don't know if a character trait is the right word, but a practice that Morris followed in setting up some of his projects was that Morris would come up with these projects that were impossible, that the other people, you know, experts in the field would say weren't feasible. Morris would find a young, eager, naive graduate student or young professional and task them with doing that. And because the young professional graduate student was young and naive, they didn't know that it was impossible. And they figured out a way to get it done. And I think the Siberian Tiger Project is a perfect example of this happening.
Yeah, and this idea of green fire is that, you know, there are species that, I guess you call them keystone species, that are vital to the ecology of a certain region. I mean, I think of the wolves of Yellowstone, for example, who have been, after their introduction, they have been involved in the recovery of so many of the areas that have been, that had been overgrazed by deer populations or elk populations out of control. How did the recovery of the Amur or Siberian tiger contribute to the health of the ecosystems around it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And honestly, it's not something that I've thought about too much. So one of the interesting things about Amur tigers is the absolutely massive home ranges that these animals require. So something like a Bengal tiger, say in Nepal, a female requires maybe a 20 square kilometer home range, right? Because the forests are productive. There's a lot of prey for them to eat. In Russia and in Northeast China, a female Amur tiger might have a home range of 400 square kilometers. Males have home ranges up to 1,400 square kilometers. And that's due to prey densities, right? The temperate forests just aren't as productive and can't sustain the same density of prey. And so the tigers there in the north have to occupy these massive ranges. I will say that Amur tigers cannot tolerate wolves. So any landscape where you have tigers, a healthy tiger population, you're not going to have wolves. So wolves were more common in Primorya in the middle of the 20th century because there weren't tigers. And then as tiger populations started to increase, wolves shrank back. Wolves moved north outside of tiger habitat. And there was a case in 2009, I believe it was, when there was a canine distemper outbreak in the Sekhotalyan Reserve in Russia, where most of the tiger book takes place. Tigers disappeared and suddenly wolves showed up. And people hadn't seen wolves for decades in this area. And then as the tiger populations started to recover, the wolves once again disappeared.
So you have a chapter on a man-eating tiger, the Kulumbe man-eater. There's a chapter on an incident of that. What did that case teach the project around the rare conditions that push the Amur tigers toward people? How did it kind of refine the conflict mitigation playbooks that the conservationists followed?
That was an interesting case, and I think it was the first, yes, it was. It was the first human-tiger conflict that Dale really went into to investigate. So as there are social instabilities, when economies are uncertain, when societies break down, you know, human societies, more people, especially in these rural areas, turn to the forest for their livelihoods. And so more people are in the woods with weapons, and more people are likely to encounter a tiger. And when they do, more people are then likely to actually take a shot at that tiger because they know that there could be an economic benefit if they're able to sell some of those body parts. So human-tiger conflicts tend to peak during these periods of instability. And the fall of the Soviet Union was one of these catalysts for this instability. And so a healthy tiger, for the most part, has no interest in humans. In my own experiences, tigers always avoid people. If they can hear a person in the forest, they run away, they crouch, they hide, they don't confront it the way Bengal tigers do in the Sundarbans, for example, of India and Bangladesh. But if a tiger is injured, if it's been shot and can't hunt as well as it naturally could, or if prey densities are depressed and there aren't as many wild boar or deer in the forest for them to eat, then they might approach people. They might come into villages looking for easy prey like dogs or cattle. And if they come across a person in the forest, they might try to kill that person for food. And with respect to the Column Bay Maneater, that specific incident, they never figured out what the motivation was behind the tiger, why the tiger killed the person that it did. But there was evidence that the tiger was sick. And so they don't know why it was sick. Maybe it was injured. Maybe it was just old. But that's the big takeaway they took was that only really injured or sick tigers are going to go after people and not healthy animals.
And I mean, this is a broader issue in conservation, conflicts between people and animals. And in fact, conservationists have been criticized for prioritizing animals over people. What is the best way to foster a win-win situation for animals and people in the field of conservation?
Yeah, I think the absolute key is, and you touched on it, is ensuring that the people who live in, we're talking here just about Amur tigers, the people who share habitat with the Amur tigers, that they feel valued by the government, right? That their needs are more important than the needs of an endangered species. And so something that the Siberian Tiger Project started doing around the year 2000 was partnering with the Provincial Wildlife Department to very quickly address any human tiger conflicts as they came up. So someone would see tiger tracks in their yard, maybe perhaps tracks that appeared like maybe the tiger was stalking a cow, or someone finds their dog dead. You know, they call the Provincial Wildlife Department, and instantly a conflict resolution team is mobilized. So it can take hours to drive somewhere across the province, but within 24 hours, usually a team, a mixed team of provincial wildlife authorities and Siberian Tiger Project staff were there on the scene, talking to the villager, talking to the farmer, understanding what happened, and trying to understand the motivations of the tiger. Is it just a dispersing male who's hungry and it's his first winter on his own, and maybe he's not going to come back? Maybe just setting off fireworks around a cow carcass is enough just to spook that tiger and he won't come back. Maybe when they look at the tracks in the snow of the tiger, maybe they see that there's some blood. Maybe they see that the tiger is limping. In that case, maybe they need to try to catch the tiger and assess its physical condition. Maybe the tiger is okay if they just keep it in captivity for a couple of days, or maybe it's too old or it's too sick and needs to go into captivity. And so having the public understand that they're safe, and once a tiger appears, there's a network of support that can alleviate their concerns, that's absolutely key. If someone thinks that, okay, a tiger's here and the only way this is going to be resolved is if I shoot it or if I poison it, then conservation is not going to work. That won't be sustainable.
You know, we live in a world that is increasingly destabilizing. Jonathan Slatt, your book, Tigers Between Empires, really describes collaboration between scientists of very different political regimes in their countries, changes in that. I mean, there was the poaching came back after the fall of the Soviet Union, and the tigers have been able to recover in spite of that. There have been geopolitical tensions. There are geopolitical tensions now, of course, between the U.S. and Russia and China. Talk about what this book can teach us about the kind of collaboration between scientists of different countries that can help to keep conservation efforts on track.
I'll start by saying that the early 1990s was an absolutely remarkable time in Russia. There was this sense of opportunity where anything was possible, right? They'd just kind of gone through these however many, 70, 80 years of the Soviet Union, and suddenly the walls went down, right? And people like Dale could come to Russia and could bring in new ideas and new technologies and just new views that were novel and absolutely refreshing for the Russians. And they were able to kind of put aside differences in language. Dale spoke no Russian going over, and focus on what their shared passions were. And in this case, it was tiger conservation. And for conservation of large species like tigers, where their range transcends borders, or migratory birds that might breed in a place like Russia and winter in a place like Australia, you have to have this international collaboration, or it's not going to work. I like to think of international conservation in the sense like a jigsaw puzzle, right? Where if you have the whole piece of a bird's flyway, for example, but you're missing that one piece from Russia, or the one piece from the Yellow Sea, or the one piece from Australia, then it's incomplete and it's not going to work. And so I've been encouraged to see that there are still collaborations continuing, given the recent geopolitical tensions between Russia and the West. People are still viewing conservation issues in the correct light, and that these are international issues that transcend politics and need to be addressed in a collective, collaborative fashion.
And finally, in the coming decades, at a time when the pressures on natural populations like the Amur tiger, of climate change, of roads being constructed, habitat loss due to roads, due to deforestation happen, what may be, say, one or two critical things, policies or commitments that are needed in order to preserve this population and to keep its recovery intact?
It's imperative that national governments are on board with conservation. There's only so much that NGOs like the Wildlife Conservation Society or WWF or IFAW, there's only so much that we as civil society can do. We cannot create protected areas. So I'm absolutely encouraged by recent developments from both the Russian and the Chinese governments to conservation. In May 2024, the Russian and Chinese governments announced that they were going to start managing two protected areas together. So it's Land of the Leopard National Park in Russia and Northeast China Tiger and Leopard National Park in China. In the past, the Chinese side would come up with tiger numbers on their side and conservation action on their side, and the Russians would do the same. And so this is the first time that these two protected areas are being looked at and managed as one, and I'm delighted to see it.
Well, that is great. It is so nice to be able to read about a good news story when it comes to biodiversity, which is under so much threat, as we know. Jonathan Slatt, your book is Tigers Between Empires, The Improbable Return of Great Cats to the Forests of Russia and China. And it's just been a delight to talk with you about this. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks for having me on, Francesca.
Go to writersvoice.net for links to photos of the Amur tigers and conservationists described in Tigers Between Empires. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.